Science Faction is for adults only, and the cool kids smoking behind the racquetball courts.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 300, Science Faction, the origins of writing.
We're going to cover, like, from Shakespeare to...
Yeah, that's when writing started. Before, it was just a bunch of people yelling out the window at each other, and then Shakespeare goes, hey, I know, I should write some of this down.
I thought it went the other way. I thought, like, it was just a bunch of cavemen painting dicks on a wall, but Shakespeare, an early Shakespeare, gave form, gave word, put it to pen.
No,
like,
it's not that Shakespeare invented, like, the word dick. It's more that he just best elocuted a description. Like, he would have been the guy who came up with veiny and throbbing. He didn't just come up with the word dick.
Yeah, like, we don't talk about Shakespeare's trashy novels. An Oberon's long throbbing member.
So you might
just into Puck punitively.
Wow, way to actually pull out a Shakespeare character. You were paying attention that 1 hour in high school.
A lot of Midsummer's Night fan fiction.
You even knew the actual play? Wow, I am thoroughly impressed. You might ask, what does writing have to do with science? Why would this be a topic of science? Well, writing is a science-based question, if you think about it. Writing is one of the first requirements for science to take place, not only because you need to note the results and monitor your work, but also because all science is based on previous work that comes before it. And unless you just call up all your scientist buddies and have them come to a room and tell you everything they did, it's not going to work out unless you can read what they have written. So writing becomes this crucial prerequisite for us to be able to do any kind of scientific endeavor. You need to not only communicate with your contemporaries, so not just talk to the people around you who are also doing interesting stuff, but
you have
be able
to talk over the head of the layman.
Yeah, well, that's true. You use a lot of Latin words, throbbing in ya.
Well, to be fair, using proper grammar and punctuation talks over the head of your average layman. We're talking about America here.
That's true. But you also need to be able to receive communication from your predecessors by reading work. So it's not just about being able to communicate with others in your time. It's about being able to communicate literally outside of your own time.
Time travel? What you're saying?
It kind of is. Like, it kind of is. Travel. I mean, you kind of are. You're getting information or ideas from a previous era.
So in a way, any scientist who has published is immortal.
Or anybody who publishes anything.
Dr. Seuss is immortal.
True. Or just the Instagram chick who has published a bunch of butt photos.
Yeah, Andrew Wakefield to this. Yeah, Andrew Wakefield is fucking immortal.
He's absolutely immortal. You know how many deaths he's caused? Single-handedly?
He's the Highlander. He's decapitating young kids.
And it's not just science, but arguably the truly accurate transmission of culture. It allows you to hear firsthand from those long dead and transmit culture between two groups that are separated by vast distances of space or time. So think about what that means. I mean, if you wanted to talk to somebody who was in China 2,000 years ago and you were in Western Europe, you could, I guess, get on a horse and try and go there, but more...
Or you'd have a really long can with a really long string.
Yeah. Wait, no, they didn't have cans yet. Maybe a coconut.
If it was a Pacific. Tried that? That never works.
How long...
No, it works.
What's the maximum dialing distance for the can?
It depends if you have VOIP can or... So you would want to send some kind of communication that could work much more quickly. It also helps people be able to start segmenting society and build a civilization and a culture because you can send your orders across vast distances without it being messed up. And you can get accurate transmission of ideas. If you think about what happens with oral history, with stories, we have a game called Telephone where things change as you tell it from person to person. If you have that going on, you're trying to run an empire and you say, store 100 bushels of grain here and 500 here. And so eventually that's going to get telephoned out and it's going to become a catastrophe and you're not going to get the administration that you need.
I don't know. The king's going mad. He wants me to bore 100 things of Maine. I don't. Off with his head.
So it gets into the question of what is writing? And if I ask you that, so what would you guys define as writing?
Dirty limericks, mostly.
Yeah, you're mainly a Weird Al writing-centric.
There once was a man named Enos.
Robert, any ideas?
Well, as a scientist, we have it down pat. We have a very specific definition. You have to describe something in as complicated a way as possible.
Oh, scientific writing.
Yeah. The passive voice must be used.
Sure. How dare there ever be an individual thinking a thought?
Of course. And if there's ever two words to choose from, you always choose the more obtuse.
Yes.
I mean, philosophy knows this. The IRS knows this. That's I don't true. Know why everybody else can't
figure it out. The lawyers certainly know it.
Yeah.
Ernest Hemingway did not know this.
So think about it. If you were to say, well, it's a mark on a piece of paper that transmits an idea. No, that actually does not qualify as writing. That's symbolic art. So that can be anything from a picture or a pictograph that represents something. And we've been doing this since at least 40,000 years ago. We have the Lascaux cave paintings. And you can look up there in that mammoth. It could just literally be me drawing a mammoth. Or it could mean this is the place where we hunt mammoths. And this is a symbolic piece of information that we're transmitting to other people in our culture.
Where do hieroglyphs fit into this?
Hieroglyphs are part of it. We're not there yet. So if you think about it, what's the difference? Well, the difference is we will never know what that mammoth means, right? We can't look at that mammoth and say anything other than it's a mammoth. Because if it does have symbolic meaning, and undoubtedly it probably did, it died out with the culture that made it. You would have to be in that culture and know that meaning in order to infer it when you got there. You couldn't just look at that picture and understand. Maybe mammoth meant something completely different. They're like, mammoths are big. We like really fat ladies. This is where the fat ladies hang out. Hence the mammoth
they
picture on the
warm,
wall.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We just got to find a mammoth named Rosetta.
That's translates it to hieroglyphs, and then we can go to Latin.
So what you're saying is, like, if we had some time machine, and I could make you invisible, Bobby, and you could go back into to where this culture was appreciating this mammoth.
Right.
Like, you could theoretically walk in and fly on the wall, look at this mammoth, nothing to you. A guy from the tribe comes back from the hunt, sees this, chuckles at it for 5 minutes, like, you had to be there.
It's a great story. So basically, we have symbolic art that goes back at least 40,000 years, probably much older. We've talked before about symbolic art that we've found that are at 70,000 years, some that are actually in the hundreds of thousands of years. And that could have very advanced meaning, and we would just never know it. You go from that to something like proto-writing, which are glyphs or pictures that represent a symbol. So now you have an abstract symbol. Maybe it's two dots and a line, and that's
two girls in a cup.
That's what it would mean, right? Again, if you have these things, they can be abstract or not, but these things represent an idea. Okay, this is a bird, right? And so this is a bird hieroglyph. This means bird. That's fine. And that helps. That is a good stepping stone inside it. Because now, let's say we have a symbol for wheat. I can now write down, all right, this is a wheat symbol. And then we have a symbol that's for numbers. So I'm going to put this wheat symbol and then the number 100. And I'm going to do this 3 times. And now I can send this to the far end of the reach. And they know that I need 300 bushels of wheat. Great. This is fantastic. Now that telephone problem isn't happening. We have a direct translation from me to you. It's still not writing, though. It's still proto-writing for a few reasons. One is those glyphs or pictures only represent a specific idea. When we get to writing, whether it's a glyph or a picture or whatever we want, a letter, whatever we want to call it, represents a part of speech, usually a sound. So this sound can then be broken up and combined with other versions to make any word. So if you have the bird symbol, and then somebody makes a new word for something new. Now all of a sudden they discovered this plant that's really good for use as contraception. Well, if you don't already have a symbol for that plant, you have to create a new one. But you can't just mix and match parts of other symbols to create the word for that plant, which we can do with letters. Before there was anything called a computer, nobody knew what a computer was. It wasn't a thing. But somebody could write the word computer, and somebody in the 1600s who had never seen a computer and wouldn't understand what it is could still read the word computer and get the same word out of it. So the idea is, do you have these little bits that represent sound that you can then combine to make a word, or do you just have pictures that represent an idea? So pictures that represent an idea are just part of proto-writing. And then you don't get to writing until you have those. And that also allows you to do things like add parts of grammar that you wouldn't otherwise have. Because the Egyptians didn't have hieroglyphs for the words and or there or something like that. They would just put basically nouns. It's like noun, 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 which makes it really hard to translate if you don't know what you're doing. Even if you do know what you're doing, sometimes it's hard to impossible. Whereas if you break up parts of speech into symbols that represent sounds, you can write anything from any language.
Was it also hard to convey certain things in hieroglyphs or proto-writing? Like, let's say I wanted to say, the smug bird. Maybe I, as the artist, am trying to draw a condescending bird.
Right.
And the artist isn't picking that. Maybe I want to draw a sad bird, so I draw a little teardrop, but it just looks like a gangster-ass
That bird killed a bunch of other birds.
In prison. It's up to the interpreter.
So do you guys want to take a guess as to when the first actual writing came out, or at least what we have as the first evidence of actual writing?
Well, from your description, I think I know when writing is going to die.
What's that?
Right now, as soon as emojis came out.
Oh, that's right. We went back to hieroglyphs.
We're regressing.
Damien, or as I call you an emoji, eggplant.
Eggplant, and then what's that, sweat? What's that afterwards? Peach. As an avid reader of The New Yorker, I happen to believe that anything that's not The New Yorker is the demise of writing. Now, I'm going to go back before Shakespeare. Beowulf. Beowulf was the first writing.
You're going Scandinavian. Okay.
No, that's not the case, but right. I had to throw something out.
All right. Robert, any guess?
Sumerians?
You got it. All right. So up until rather recently, Epic of Gilgamesh came later.
Yeah. Well,
but that is a Sumerian tale, but that came later. Up until recently, we actually thought it was Egyptian hieroglyphs, which date to around 2600 to the 2900 BC. Epic of Gilgamesh is right around in that time, by the way, about 2500 BC, maybe as far as 2700 BC. We have more recently, discovered some Sumerian tablets that go back to about 3200 BC. And by the way, this wasn't a mystery. We always kind of knew it because Egyptian hieroglyphs are derivative of Sumerian text. So the Egyptians got their writing style from the Sumerians, and we knew that based on some linguistic evidence. So we always knew that even though we were finding Egyptian stuff, it was just that we were finding it earlier and that there was probably earlier stuff in Sumer. The thing about that is we see the evolution from proto-writing literally into writing in Sumerian culture. And I would like to point out that stuff like clay tablets do not survive super well in the archaeological record. And if we're finding stuff at 3200, statistically speaking, I would say there's a good likelihood that there's much older stuff around. So I would say there's probably a pretty good chance that when we keep looking, we're going to find stuff maybe 3500, maybe a little bit older. But we also see changes in the culture of places in the Middle East around this time that are probably indicative of the advances that they got from writing. And so it isn't unrealistic to think that we're kind of nearing the time when real writing was developed around then.
Here in this writing, we could tell this is when the Middle Eastern culture started finding hairy, sweaty men very attractive. Gilgamesh was first.
Here's another question for you guys. We know of at least three independent sources of writing. So I've already given away one of them. It isn't Egypt, because Egypt is a derivative of the Sumerian text. What do you guys think might be the three independent places on the earth in which writing was developed?
I'm going to say China.
Okay.
Or China's one.
Okay. Inca. We already said Sumer, so now you got two out of the three.
Either Inca or...
This last one, I'm trying to go for comic effect.
Okay.
You know what? I'm just going to say not the Italians.
Very true. Very true. Close, Robert. Very close.
Maya?
Mesoamerica. So probably pre-Maya. Definitely pre-Inca.
Olmec.
Incas didn't come around until the 1400s. So definitely pre-Inca. But also, yeah, Mesoamerica, you would just say some of the cultures there, because we're also not sure exactly where. Remember, almost all Mesoamerican writings, aside from five, we have five codexes from the Maya. Everything else, the thousands and thousands of books that they wrote, were all burned by the Spanish. We literally have
jerks.
Five examples of an entire culture's massive libraries. It was worse than the burning of Alexandria. It was worse than everything, was the destruction of the Mayan codexes. But yes, so Mesoamerica developed independently. China developed independently. And Sumer developed independently. There might have been other places that developed independently as well that either got overrun, we never found out. Remember, Genghis Khan killed like half the world's population in the 1200s. There could have been entire cultures that were going on in there that had shit going on, and we'll never know about it. There are places, obviously, the vast majority of them, that never developed it. You wouldn't have something like writing come to Australia until you had settlements in the 1700s. You wouldn't have writing come to a lot of islands until basically Europeans got there. And that
messages in bottles.
Yeah, and... And just as a side note, this is important for my job because writing becomes the definitive transition point that we describe as the historic. So when we say something is prehistoric, literally what that means is before writing came to that area. So prehistoric Sumer starts 3200 BC. Prehistoric Australia is 1700s, something like that. So when we say prehistoric, sometimes people think we're talking about a global time frame, and we're not. We're talking about where writing came to that specific area.
So if we were to go to an illiterate town in Appalachia,
This
is a prehistoric town. None of the history of this culture has been preserved.
There had some smart-ass Thomas Jefferson planter motherfucker out there at some point. They just lost it.
Big city liberal like Thomas Jefferson.
Very interesting, and it's an interesting delineation, really important for science, really important for culture, and something that I think people kind of don't really consider enough is when do we make that transition from pictures that mean something to writing that means something, and how drastically that affects our culture and our ability to have large-scale civilizations.
Eggplant emoji, eggplant emoji, eggplant emoji.
All right, and speaking of eggplant emoji, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy, and with me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing great. I don't send eggplant emojis. I think that's immature. I just go straight for the dick pic. Don't tease people. Just send them the people what they want. Don't want, and request several times for you to stop.
Yeah, and sometimes get restraining orders.
Please can't stop me.
And speaking of somebody who doesn't have any restraining orders, our science guest host for the afternoon, Dr. Robert Cooper. Dr. Cooper, how you doing?
A little bit worried because I've been taking my notes on clay tablets, and you just said they're not very durable.
That's true. They're more durable than paper, arguably. I mean, paper isn't lasting. To me.
But these don't even keep past 3,000 years.
Everybody's getting a tablet.
How am I supposed to be immortal?
And if you want to be immortal, go ahead and check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com, where we'll list all the articles we cover here, as well as some we don't get to.
I'm picturing Robert, you know, transitions to paper, and like he's like, finally, all of his notes are translated from tablet onto paper, wipes sweat off his brow, hears a knock at the door, it's a bunch of Spaniards. Hey, I didn't see your notes. Like torches behind
them. Point.
Metal helmets.
Clay tablet's far less flammable.
All right, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right, article number one is actually going to be two articles, very interesting articles published within the last few weeks that explain the early Earth in a very, very interesting way. The first one has to do with something we've discussed a lot here on Science Faction, something that you Science Faction regular listeners will be familiar with, which is the collision with Theia.
Mother Earth cannot drive and hit another planet early on.
Yeah, she's basically taking the SUV around, but she's looking at her cell phone.
Doing her fucking makeup in the mirror while driving at a stoplight.
We've talked about this before. During the early formation of the Earth, we're talking about 4.3, 4.4 billion years ago, the Earth literally had a collision with another planet, which it boggles my mind to think of the impact that this would be. So this is the Earth going around in its normal orbit, happens to smash into a Mars-sized planet. The result was that the two of those combined and basically melded together in a big molten ball, shooting off a little bit of remains, which would then coalesce into what we now call the moon. And that set our planet spinning at its current rotation. It set it at its current velocity. This is why we have our 24-hour day. This is why we have a moon that's rotating around. This is why we are in the orbit that we are in, all because of this collision with Theia.
If this happened again tomorrow.
Yes.
Now, I know that it would be a life-ending event.
Of course. Everything.
But how many human corpses would just be knocked into space, or would you just be like
incinerated? There'd be nothing. There would just be nothing suddenly. Like that would be so ridiculous. I actually think there would probably be a lot of deaths literally just from like weird gravitational stuff like waves and interactions long before the planet actually collided.
So I mean, I'm just thinking of a collision, and let's say your atmosphere is the windshield. How many people are going through that fucking windshield? None? Is that not possible?
Well, I mean,
guys, everybody's going to die in the rioting that happens the day before.
that's probably
in
true.
The purge that happens the day before.
Why would we purge this place? It's about to be purged. This is like cleaning before the maid comes.
Like this could have been an orgy, but it became a purge.
That's how most orgies start. They start as purges. People get horny. But what we just found out is that this collision not only sent us on our current rotation and gave us the moon and all this other stuff that we need for life, but it also likely brought in the actual elements we needed for life. So for a long time, cosmologists have been discussing why it is that we have things like carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur on our planet when we don't find those on the other rocky planets on the interior, like Mars and Venus. Why is it that we have these and the other ones don't? We already know why the other ones don't. They get burned off essentially in the early formation of the solar system. They kind of get burned off by the sun, solar winds, that kind of stuff pushes those all away. So how is it that we have some? And for a long time, the explanation was maybe there was a bunch of asteroids and all these asteroids came in and hit the Earth and they brought these with them, these organic compounds, these volatile compounds. And that's probably true for some of it. But in looking at the ratios, this basically very, very large geological study looked at all the ratios and found that there is just way too much of them for it to be accountable from these asteroidal impacts. And most likely, it came from this Theia impact. That's the only thing large enough to have brought all this stuff with it. And so the idea is you had Theia, which probably formed further out in the solar system, was able to retain its volatile compounds. And when it smashed into Earth, it exchanged them and we got them. And that's the reason we're here. That's the reason life is here. Otherwise, Earth would be just as barren as the other planets that we see in the solar system.
Like my aunt, barren.
Yeah.
It sounds like maybe Mother Earth isn't so much a bad driver as maybe she just stopped for takeout.
Yeah, we're super lucky that she stopped, right?
Because she brought dinner home for the kids.
Yeah,
pizza.
Yeah. Hey, I brought a bunch of volatile compounds and the moon.
Mom brought pizza and purple stuff, soda, Sunny D.
So that in your room for a little while though, it's a little messy out here.
Yeah, totally. So that's really interesting because it indicates that that big collision really gave birth to all life on Earth and is the reason that we're here. And maybe, we've talked a lot of times on the show about the Fermi paradox, about how we look up into the sky and we don't see radio signals, we don't see evidence of other civilizations, even though the math says that with all the billions and billions of stars and galaxies and everything, we should. Maybe the answer is that if you're in the Goldilocks zone where life can form, all the elements for life have been taken out of your planet, and it takes a really, really, really rare Theia-type collision with a planet from outside from the outer solar system in order to get the preconditions set up for life, and therefore life has to be incredibly rare and not nearly as common as we've previously thought.
Maybe the problem with the Fermi paradox, and we've kind of broached this on the show before, isn't what you said. Maybe the problem is that it came from the mouth of a fucking Italian.
Probably. They didn't have writing.
I know it. We're inside, but I'm spitting.
Like an Italian would.
I'm speaking with my hands right now.
I love racism. That's still acceptable. Like, we can still go after the Italians.
Yeah, you know
In fact, you know what? From now on, Italian. That's what we call them.
It'd be like the Me Too movement for Italians if Italian men weren't a huge part of what the Me Too movement was started for.
Yeah.
Yeah, didn't we have that like around the 1900s, early 1900s?
Yes, we did, actually. It was them and the Irish were like, yeah, get out of here.
We're a white too, please.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting thing to me because I'm always interested in the vast history that brought human beings to where they are. I think that's what makes me very interested in human paleontology and biological evolution. But also this planet formation. Think of the chances. What if we were 2 hours later in our rotation and missed that collision with Theia, and we wouldn't have the moon and we wouldn't have these organic compounds and the Earth would have remained barren and not only we wouldn't have been here, no life would have been on Earth. And just the math, it just could have happened that easily and just by chance happened to happen in such a way that set up the possibility of life. It's really interesting when you look at all this because...
So I'm an accident, Mom?
Yeah.
As I'm saying to Mother Earth, I'm an accident?
This has been kind of my argument to a lot of people who have kind of more theistic views on how we're so special because, you know, we were made in this way and stuff. And with all due respect to those people, I have to disagree and say we're really special because of how unlikely we are. Because of all the chances we had to not be here, whether you talk about the human genetic bottleneck 70,000 years ago where the entire human population was down to a few hundred people and yet we survived. Whether you talk about the fact that 99% of all species who have ever lived are extinct, yet we survived. Whether you talk about all that stuff.
Which the fact that you were the sperm that fucking won.
Yes, exactly.
You could have been a Down syndrome sperm.
Yes.
You could have been a smart sperm, you stupid theistic fuck.
If your parents would have had sex a minute and a half later than they did, you would not be here existing because the genetics that make you up would have been different. It's very, very interesting to see how lucky we are because of all the chance things that has to happen for us to be here. And one of them could have been this massive collision that would have meant that none of us were here without it.
Like as you're talking to this guy, you know how your brother is more athletic than you,
right?
Stronger. I fucked your mom at a much better time than when I fucked you.
Right.
I don't have to have this conversation with your brother. I'd like to add, he read a book.
I got to be honest. After we had your brother, your mom and I were riding, like taking a bicycle ride, and I hit the brakes too hard, and I flew off the seat and went balls first into that post that we, for some reason, have on male bicycles. And that's why you're here.
And then it happened again 3 months later, but this time your mom was driving and she was pregnant. We thought it was an abortion. But you're here. You're here. You're a happy accident.
Yeah, sorry.
We
sorry.
Love you, son.
And another article just came out recently that actually suggests that those asteroid impacts that we thought had previously thought might have brought in all the volatile chemicals, again, probably did bring some, those might be responsible for our continents. This is about 3.9 to 4 billion years ago, so about half a billion years after the Theia collision. And at this point, this is the Hadean Aeon, and we are just being bombarded. The entire planet is basically just being jacked by asteroids.
It's inner city, early 90s America.
Yeah, exactly.
This is Boys in the Hood.
Middle of the crack epidemic. This is bad.
Actually, I think it was Thea's posse.
Hey, bro!
Man, we got a broker peace between the Theas and the Gaias, man.
You got to remember, the solar system was still in its early formation period, so there was a lot of debris just floating around. All the early formation materials hadn't gotten into their full orbits yet, so you still had asteroids coming screaming through. You didn't have protection.
Hey, Earth!
Yeah. you didn't have nearly as many protections. If you want to know what the Earth looked like, just look up at the moon. I mean, you know how it's just like crater pop marks and everything? That was the Jeez. Earth just constantly being hit. Yeah, Jim Carrey's up there, right?
Yes.
That's, that was the point of that movie?
He's playing Andy Kaufman.
Okay.
He's a real character.
Okay. I just want to make sure I got the point of that movie right.
You saw it.
So we were just being bombarded by all these asteroids, and these asteroids brought with them a bunch of molten rock, and it forms giant pools of molten rock, which we think later became the formation of our continents. Now, keep in mind, we also think we got all of Earth's water from comets and asteroids crashing in at the same time, which would create the kind of water that we see that became our oceans and lakes and rivers. So without those collisions, we would not have the buildup of stuff that became, you know, Pangaea and then Gondwana land and then the individual continents that we have now. We wouldn't have the same rock formations that would allow for dry land. So maybe we would still have life, but it would all be water life. There would be no such thing as dry land. Everything would be an aquatic life form. So it's all like fish and Kevin Costner.
Oh, from The Postman, from that movie The Postman.
No, it's Dances with Wolves.
My mistake. 90s were a good time for Costner.
Yeah.
Okay, so without these asteroids hitting, there are no continents.
Yeah.
Florida.
Presumably.
Florida is made of limestone. Is that also basaltic rock?
So Florida.
Would the whole Earth.
Florida would not be there either, yes.
In a perfect world, Florida would not be there. I agree.
Well, actually, in a few years, Florida won't be there because it's almost all going to be below sea level.
What we have to do is keep the rats who are going to be leaving that ship. We got to keep them on the ship. So we need a wall.
That's where we need to build a wall. So it is a very interesting idea that we are getting everything from our continents to our oceans to the very chemicals that make up life just from these extraterrestrial impacts. And without them, we would not have this world that we lived in. And maybe with some other extraterrestrial impacts, we would have other things or a totally different world that would look very, very different. Very interesting to kind of ponder these type of things.
So because Earth took her beatings young.
Yeah.
Like she's grown up into this.
Yeah.
This very strong, resilient adult with a strong family. And all these other trust fund babies in our solar system who weren't receiving those beatings from asteroids.
Well, and you might be thinking to yourself, wait a second, why is it that we were being bombarded nonstop by enough asteroids to bring all of the water of all of the oceans and rivers and lakes and all of the molten rock for all the continents? Why is it we were bombarded then and not now? Two things. One is, again, the solar system has kind of calmed down. That was in our young period. We were throwing stuff around a lot. We've kind of settled into our
peace with Theus.
Yeah, exactly. There was a big fight, and then we all cleared it out.
Biggie and Tupac, man.
We have kind of established our orbits. We are getting some protection from some of the stuff outside. If you go outside of our solar system, you start hitting Kuiper Belt and other objects that are out there, in which case that looks a lot like the early solar system, a lot of rocks just kind of flying willy-nilly. But also, we are still getting hit by these asteroids. It's just that starting when life started 3-some-odd billion years ago and started producing different gases that then became an atmosphere, in some cases this was very oxygen-rich atmosphere because these were photosynthesizing materials, when we started producing an atmosphere, we basically created a shield around ourselves. So what does this shield do? This shield creates basically a bubble of gas that surrounds the Earth. And now when these asteroids come in, they hit it. And a lot of times, people don't recognize this, they'll bounce off. This is one of the problems with the Apollo mission when they had to come back around and try and make it to Earth. If they didn't hit their trajectory just right, you hit it and you literally will bounce off the atmosphere. So a lot of these bounce off. And then the ones that don't often burn up before they hit the Earth. So not only is everything calmer out in space where we are, not only do we have things that are kind of settled down, and by the way, that moon, the moon acts kind of like a protectant too, because a lot of times asteroids...
Where's a condom? Everywhere it goes.
Yeah. Well, asteroids that are coming towards us get caught by the moon's gravity and swung around the other way. So the moon acts to protect us thanks to that Theia collision. The solar system itself has calmed down, and then now we have this great atmosphere which protects us additionally.
I mean, could the moon ever redirect an asteroid into Earth?
Yeah, theoretically, but if you look at the math, there are, in just a lateral plane, 359 degrees it can swing it away from the Earth and only 1 degree into it. And then if you have to extend that to a full rotational plane, I think there are thousands and thousands of degrees that it could swing away from the Earth and only a few that it could swing towards it.
So we're due.
Yes, Damien, that's what I was getting at. All right, on to article number two. Climate change fucks up fertility before it kills you.
Nobody wants to fuck when it's hot. Look at equatorial countries.
Wait, there's a lot of people
yeah,
fucking
that's what
there.
I'm saying. What do you mean?
That's where people go.
Bad science. Call bad science right now.
No, that's not this one. So this is really interesting. I love these stories because this isn't necessarily a story where they go, hey, look, we just discovered we were totally wrong about how hot it's getting and we need to change those numbers. What they decided is, but hey, guys, we are looking at the wrong metric for trying to analyze the damage to species by climate change. Before, we were looking at something called CTL, which is basically the temperature...
When somebody gets concussions in their testicles over a long period of time.
Yeah, from bicycles. It's the critical thermal limit, or the temperature at which animals stop moving, they collapse, or they die. And they were saying, listen, this species, let's say it's a random rat, it's not going to survive once the temperature gets up a little bit higher because they're going to hit their CTL. Well, that's logical and fine. But the problem is that species is actually going to die out well before that, because it's not just whether or not that animal dies. It's about whether there's a next generation of that animal. And what these researchers pointed out was, hey, guys, we're looking at the wrong metric. We need to see the temperature at which they stop fucking, because once we get there, then that species is dead. It doesn't matter if that individual animal lives out its years. That species dies off in that area, and it's due to climate change, and it happens long before we hit the CTL.
Okay, two questions. One, what happens? Like, is there a certain point at which the testicles boil within the body before death?
Undoubtedly, that's what's going on. No, there's just they work within a certain range of temperatures, and once you boost those temperatures up, those animals are not going to act the same. Maybe it's because they only mate during certain times of the season, and once you switch when the temperature ranges are, the season doesn't line up between food resources and temperature and whatever, and they just don't mate.
What is that temperature for humans? Because in very hot places like Phoenix or even the much hotter Baghdad, people still breed. People have been breeding there for a long time. And by the way, true. In Phoenix, they have shit like air conditioning.
Yes.
And where it's much hotter in Baghdad, they don't have that. And they're still fucking in
they
Baghdad.
They don't have air conditioning in Baghdad because it's much cooler than Phoenix. That is a fact.
Really? Okay, bad science. Bad science again. Okay. I'm already winning.
For those of you guys who don't know, when Damien was deployed in Iraq, he had some kind of vacation, I was working in Phoenix, Arizona, where it was much, much hotter, and I reminded him on a regular basis how much hotter it was.
Yeah, I joined ISIS for a summer, and like me and Bobby had this like weird rivalry thing.
So we have to use this to estimate kind of bio impacts on these creatures. You know, how is our ecology going to react to temperature rises? Well, if we were just looking at CTLs before, we had a really skewed perspective of how bad that damage was going to be, because it turns out you don't need to get anywhere near that CTL to get certain species to stop breeding.
Again, we didn't get to the bottom of what temperature would you say man hits that I won't fuck?
That's hard, because
man fucks.
Yeah, I did a project.
Yeah, I don't think humans have a
little. Yeah.
Hey, buddy, blow my testicles.
I did a project out in the desert where I had a bunch of ARCs working for us, and we were literally hitting 120 on multiple days, 120 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's like a Baghdad winter.
Yeah. And when we were doing that, there was a lot of hooking up going on in that crew. I will tell you that. So I'm going to say we don't stop.
I'm glad that you and your professors,
but at least
you and the old men you work with were able to have a good time in the desert.
At least we had AC. So we have to kind of reevaluate how we look at the impact of this. And I always love this, because this is science correcting itself. It's not science saying, hey, we were wrong about these numbers. It's science saying we were looking at the wrong numbers, which is a conceptual framework that needs to change. And perfecting our conceptual frameworks is actually, in my opinion, more important than actually perfecting the data. Because we can always go collect that data whenever we decide what it is we need to find. But figuring out the right conceptual framework to decide what data needs to be collected or what the impacts of that data are, to me, is a much more important thing. We could have gone on taking the most precise measurements ever and not realize that we were measuring for a benchmark that was the wrong benchmark to get to. So these type of papers are always the most interesting to me, also because somebody should have stepped up and said this 10 years ago.
Is there like a temperature where they just complain a lot?
That's yeah. Called Florida, actually.
They can still breed at this point, but yeah. You don't want to be around them.
That's New York transplants to Florida right there.
So I wonder if it's more of an issue with like warm-blooded animals, because when it gets really hot, you're like, I just do not want another warm body anywhere near me right now.
That's really interesting you say that, because certain groups are thought to be more vulnerable, and it's actually cold-blooded animals and aquatic species.
Is that because their gender depends on the temperature?
Part of that is true, yes. And we talked a little bit about that last week, that temperature can change gender in reptiles and cold-blooded species. But also, if you're not endothermic, we are endothermic, so we can maintain our body temperature. If you're not endothermic, and you have to go out places to be able to sustain and maintain your temperature, and you also have a very hard time cooling off, you're going to spend more time and resources trying to regulate your temperature than you are to try and find food and mate. And mating goes away first. And so therefore, all of a sudden, you're worried about your thermal index, whereas us mammals, we got a little bit of a built-in buffer there because we're endothermic. So yeah, it affects them much, much more, aquatic species as well, because warming of the waters is going to affect their breeding times.
So if we're going to save these species, we have to do kind of a Jurassic Park thing. We need scientists out there now seeing these exhausted, hot animals laying on their back. And we need to extract their gametes through sensual gloved hand jobs. And we're going to have to recreate these species for future generations once we cool the earth down with air conditioners.
Do you know how air conditioners work?
Yep.
You know they put out 2 units of heat for every unit of cold that they make.
Yeah, but we have that big tube going out into space.
Fair enough.
Just have a collision with like a really icy comet.
We'll bring in like a really frigid comet, cool down the earth a little bit.
What about Pluto? It's looking like it's PR guy. Can we bring Pluto? I have a collab.
What would the Pluto-Earth collaboration be called?
End times? The apocalypse?
See, I was going more like ironic. I was going to use the term twins based on the Danny DeVito Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Wait, which one are we?
Schwarzenegger.
God damn.
We're way bigger. We're way bigger, and Pluto's married to Rhea Perlman, so it has to be us.
Yeah, dude, you got to give Danny DeVito credit for being cool, for like... If you were to tell the Danny DeVito, this is what you're going to look like, this is what you're going to sound like your whole life.
Right.
And he took that, and he still crushed it.
Yeah.
And he's banging sweet-ass Rhea Perlman.
Could Pluto regain planet status through marriage?
To stay in the country, yes.
Yeah. It has to marry a noble planet, though. That's the only way it works.
Planet that doesn't interact with other planets.
Very, very interesting. All right, thank you so much, audience, for joining us for Science Faction 300, where you learned about the origins of writing, how a collision with Theia and then subsequent collisions with asteroids gave us the life and the Earth that we currently know, and how climate change will mess up species long before they die. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back this Thursday for Science Faction 301.
So we learned there's a temperature in which animals don't want to reproduce, but is there also a temperature where they won't want to blow me?
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.